Hi, and welcome to Book Talk. I'm Sasha DeBoyle, and today we're going to be talking about the classic graphic novel Persepolis by Marjane Satrapi. Persepolis is the story of a young Marjane, or Margie, as she grows up in Iran, and the impact that the Islamic Revolution in 1979 has on her life and the lives of those around her. Giving us their thoughts today are Damon Hurd, PhD researcher at the Scottish Centre for Comic Studies, and Mona Vagefian, communications coordinator from the Edinburgh Iranian Festival. Did you like the book? What were your overall impressions of it?
When I first read the book, when it first came out, I didn't like it. One of the precursors to this book was a book called Epileptic by David Bee, published by L'Association in France, the same people that published Persepolis originally. And that is one of my favourite books ever, in stark black and white, talking about history and his family history and stuff. I think David Bee encouraged Marjane to write this book. And for me, it was an inferior book to Epileptic, so it suffered a lot in comparison. Yeah. And over the years, I've grown to like it a bit better, and I appreciate sort of aspects of it a lot more than I did in that first initial reading.
I'm glad you said that you didn't like it at first, because I'm actually kind of the same. I came to it with probably high expectations, but for a different reason. I think because it was one of the first breakthrough books about depicting kind of a sort of person growing up in Iran against the backdrop of the revolution. I had sort of quite high standards I was probably holding it to subconsciously. But again, I've also come to think of it as better than I originally felt it to be. And I think it's sort of more than the sum of its parts. I think if you take the components separately, the writing isn't particularly striking or beautiful. I find the visuals very striking and the illustrations very striking, but I can see that there's not a huge amount of variation in it. It's quite sort of, it's quite repetitive. Certainly when you read the two books in one, the kind of, the effect sort of loses its sort of impact, I think, over the course of the two books. But I think that definitely come to kind of hold it in higher regard than I initially did.
It's funny that you talk about the two books, because it was originally published in four books when it was published in France. And it also has these very small episodic strips that sort of tell different stories that have titles. So, you know, the cigarette or the return or specific small moments. And I do think that that episodic nature does mean that when it's collected together, it feels a bit bulky at times, even though I did really enjoy it. It made me think of books that used to be published in volumes, like the Victorian novels. We chose Persepolis this month because we wanted to focus on a graphic novel, a classic graphic novel, and also one that might appeal to people who weren't particularly interested in traditional superhero comics. I wanted to ask if you guys thought it fit the bill there and how you feel about Persepolis as sort of a classic that could draw in new readers.
I think it definitely fits that bill. I remember when the collected edition, the smaller paperback version, came out, that's all the books in one. I was actually working in a bookshop at the time and I was in charge of the graphic novel section, and we just couldn't keep it in the shop. It was flying off the shelves, and it certainly wasn't comics fans that were buying it. It was like, I would say 95% of the people that were buying it were people who'd heard about it, and it was this biography of this woman from Iran. And obviously this was, I guess, mid-2000s, and it's like, and everything that's been going on in the Middle East recently over the last sort of decade or so. So it's something that people are looking to find out more about. And so it works quite well as that, I think. And it's like non-comics readers, but you're getting some sort of sense of a particular part of the world's history.
Yeah, and that's definitely the perspective that I came at it from. I certainly didn't come at it from the perspective of a graphic novel or comic book reader at all. I think Iran tends to get sort of polarized between nuclear sort of aspirational state, axis of evil on one end, and then sort of kind of Persian classical, kind of the culture of poetry, pre-Islamic.
But there's almost an exoticism and orientalism to that.
Exactly. And I think this begins to kind of provide some shading in between those two poles. And although I think Marjane is not, you know, she's not a typical Iranian. I think we get that sense as you go through the book. You know, she mentions her dad drives a Cadillac, but the fact that she begins to put some kind of flesh on the bones of an Iranian and a woman growing up in Iran during that period, it certainly kind of is pretty fresh, I think, for most people.
She did say in the introduction of the collected edition that she wanted to show that Iran was more than just fundamentalism, fanaticism, and terrorism. So it was nice to see a different side of that. Although I did really like the way the narrative voice sort of approached those things, because it's presented from a child's perspective and a really, really precocious little brat too. You know, that every time that she would learn something new about history or about a particular political movement, she would be like, that's me then, this is my belief, and then believe it so fervently with that sort of zeal of a child that only a kid could get behind. I really liked that sort of approach to it, because then as she learned more, she would then unpick the problems with each sort of political side or historical piece of context and then move on. So it allowed you to learn with the book, which was really cool.
I think that's one of the strengths of the book, actually. It's how it depicts a child's world really specifically, and that enthusiasm you were talking about how when they learn something new or they go into something else. And by the end of the first book, it's hard to believe sometimes that she's only 14 when she gets sent away.
I know.
And because she's been this precocious brat, as you say, throughout the whole book. And I think that was one of the things that put me off it as well, is I didn't really like her as a person.
Completely agree. Completely agree.
She made me laugh out loud, though.
But I think she's more self-aware on later readings than I realised on the first reading of it. And she does kind of talk about how, in the introduction, as you say, it's about the people who are not forgotten, the people who are like have died in prisons or had to leave the country and stuff like that.
I think it can be quite difficult as well when dealing with a book that has such difficult subject matter and has, you know, history of violence and that sort of thing in it. You sort of expect a certain kind of telling. You come in with this expectation, and when you meet someone who flat out refuses to be a victim of a particular regime, you're like, whoa, wait a second, you're not just lying down and taking it. You know, you're telling the nuns in the place that you're staying that you thought they were all prostitutes and you got kicked out of your school.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's possibly comes from privileged background as well. But also I think her parents were quite open, and her parents were obviously quite against the regime and enjoyed the lifestyle before the Islamic Revolution and stuff as well.
Mm. Really interesting to see the cultural changes there before and after.
Yeah, and I think what you were saying, Sasha, about her kind of unpicking all her beliefs and kind of evolving very much over the course of the first book. I think at some point in the second book, during the day, they're all sort of veiled and kind of conforming. And, you know, she gets told off even for wearing red socks and kind of the pettiness of that. But she almost, a lot of the young people at the university live almost sort of a schizophrenic lifestyle. I think that might be even the word that she uses, because, you know, to forget all of that repression and sort of constraints during the day, they're having wild parties during the night, you know. A lot of them have boyfriends and they're drinking and all that kind of thing. And I think that is quite an interesting sort of dynamic, because it almost mirrors the state that she's grown up in. It's gone from being a kind of decadent, very westernized culture under the Shah to, you know, there's a people's revolution, and then that gets sort of overtaken by an Islamic fundamentalist core, and that sort of takes over. And so she's seen so many shifts, and then, you know, she moves to the West, and again she's sort of an outsider. It kind of feels like she's a perpetual outsider, and it's interesting to see that evolution. I think
it really does show sort of the complexities of the sort of political climate in Iran. I think people would have just heard, oh yeah, there's a revolution and now these people are in charge, and I think they would have just assumed that the only revolutionaries were the people that then sort of took over, so the Islamic sort of core there. But it was really interesting to see that actually there were a huge amount of political prisoners that were different revolutionaries arguing for different causes, including, you know, relations and friends of hers. And that's where you really get the sort of insight into the political.
Yeah, and I think as well the depiction of the Iran-Iraq war, which lasted for 6 years, but often gets forgotten when you think about the history of Iran. Certainly the headlines of Iran over the recent years are kind of, you know, the Islamic Revolution sticks out, and then you've got, you know, various subsequent sort of regimes that have kind of achieved sort of various levels of notoriety because of this sort of nuclear situation and things like that. But I think the impact of the Iran-Iraq war on the country and that kind of prolonged experience of being at war is quite an interesting addition to the historical element of the book.
But as well, I mean, because of that child's perspective, she is at one remove from a lot of the violence. And that's where some of the really nice graphic elements come into it, because these are things she hears about. So that's when her imagination comes into play. So, for example, there's a bit at the start of the book where a cinema in Tehran is bombed, and obviously she isn't there and she doesn't see the graphic images associated with it because her parents are like, well, you're a kid. But you see this drawing that she has of all of these sort of skulls and souls flying in flames out of a cinema, and it's a really arresting image. And I really liked sort of seeing where a child's imagination could take you to deal with that sort of an issue or a thing that would happen.
Yeah, there's elements of that where she uses comics quite well, actually. Mm-hmm. There's a bit later on, I think, is it one of her friends' houses is bombed? She kind of is looking into it, and there's just a black, the next panel is black. Yeah. As she's looking at it, what this horror that's in front of her. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of using comics in a really nice way at that point.
Yeah.
It's kind of because it's all in, you imagine it now, that how horrible it is.
Exactly. And because it's not like it goes into huge detail. It's not like scenes of destruction, which actually you do often get in comic books. You get these huge splash pages, two pages across, full colour of like death and destruction. And you don't get that with this, but you do get the stark realities of how that impacts on individuals' lives. Mm-hmm. And I did really like that.
I think as well, the sort of the black and white and the very kind of simplistic, repetitive imagery is quite sort of effective for depicting like an authoritarian regime. There's sort of quite a good sort of mirroring in the imagery of how it feels to kind of be sort of just one of many people, not sort of picked out as an individual, that kind of thing. If you have to be veiled, you know, everyone feels like they look the same, that kind of thing. I think that worked quite well.
There's also a really humorous nod to that within the style of the art and her background, because obviously she goes to art school and has to practice drawing people, but she's a woman living in a fundamentalist regime, so they have to do life drawing classes with a woman in a full head-to-toe chador, and they can't see anything, and they're like, well, at least we got to practice drawing drapes. Just that bit always gets me. It's so funny. And then they end up having life drawing classes in secret and bringing their art to their art teacher and being like, look what we did.
I think the scenes like that, they really bring the sort of ridiculousness of the extreme fundamentalist, the way the country is being run. And it's like, look, it's gone so far, this just makes no sense.
And it's also good because it provides lighter points to the book, because obviously the book could be like truly depressing, but it's not actually. It's really funny. Something that Persepolis does is obviously it sits within a much bigger tradition of autobiographical and biographical storytelling in comic books. How do you think it sits within that sort of wider tradition? It's been compared to stuff like Joe Sacco's Palestine, Art Spiegelman's Mouse. Do you think that that's fair? Do you think it's good?
Yeah, I think it is. Because sometimes one of the arguments you get against sort of, especially the books you've listed in Persepolis that are quite political in their, in their investigating pieces of history and politics. And people say, well, is this valid for comic book storytelling? And that's one of the arguments that I would always give against it, is there's no story that isn't valid for comic book storytelling.
Yeah.
Because even though she's Iranian, she obviously spent, she says, over half her life outside Iran, in Vienna and in France and in Paris. And so I think the book Persepolis comes out of a French tradition of like La Société, the original publisher. Yeah. It really does fit in. And the politics, if we hadn't had Palestine, if we hadn't had Mouse, we wouldn't have got Persepolis.
These things
have to happen for us.
And it's funny, actually, because I think Palestine and Mouse specifically as well are books that have had a huge crossover in literary appeal. I mean, you know, Mouse won a Pulitzer. It's interesting to then see, as we were talking about this smaller collected graphic novel edition of Persepolis, it doesn't look like a comic book when you pick it up. Like, no, apart from the cover, it looks like a book. And it is exactly the same size and shape on my bookshelf as other big literary books that I have. When I remember when I put it on there, I was like, oh, that's interesting. It never fit on the comic shelf, but it fits on this shelf. How clever. And it's also published by Vintage in the UK.
Yeah, I mean, and all that's completely deliberate, isn't it?
Yeah, it's completely.
Like, they've obviously realised that this was the thing to market. And when I was saying it was flying off the shelves, I think we had the original edition, which is in two volumes in the UK.
But that's interesting, because I think maybe all of us have looked at both editions, and I certainly found that the paperback version of the combined volumes is sort of more difficult to read.
It's one of my bugbears as well, that when they do try to mass market it and they shrink it down, and so you, as you're saying, it's harder to read the artwork and the lines aren't as crisp and they kind of fade out a little bit. That's obviously a sacrifice that the publishers think is worth making.
Yeah, and I mean, it obviously paid off.
Yeah.
Yes. I have to say, it is something, I don't think I noticed it the first time around, but rereading, I was like, oh, this writing is small. And also, like, the print quality, you're right, like, some of the pages where you would get, like, a, you know, a scene that was mostly black, and you're like, this isn't, it's fading a little bit, and you don't really get the full punch of what you see, which is interesting. So Mona, as an Irish-Iranian and someone who works for the Edinburgh Iranian Festival, how did you find the outsider narrative of Persepolis as someone who, you know, is Iranian but has never fully lived in Iran?
There's a part, and I think it might be the first or the second part, where she says something along the lines of, I was a Westerner in Iran. I think that's a sort of nod to the fact that her parents were very liberal, but an Iranian in the West. And I think that's something that certainly a lot of the Iranian expat community sort of feel, that sort of inherent contradiction of you might hold Western values and you might not necessarily sympathize with the current regime in Iran. But everywhere you go, you're kind of perceived and approached as a representative of Iran and Iranian culture and so on. So that's certainly something that I really enjoyed. And I think also, as someone who sort of, I certainly take kind of quite a strong interest in Iranian culture and that its depiction in the West, I think a lot of the voices that have come out of Iran, they're not populist voices. They haven't written sort of massively populist books. I think they reach a certain audience in the UK, but don't sort of necessarily penetrate beyond that. Whereas I think Persepolis has quite a broad appeal, not just because of its being a comic book, but also just because it's that much more accessible and a personal, engaging memoir. So I think that's brilliant.
I would sort of wonder about its reception in Iran, actually, because she makes it clear within the book that, you know, she is well educated, that she's of a certain class, and that when she goes back to Iran from having been in the West, that her friends are not like her and that they still have this sort of more mass culture approach to Western culture, where they're very much, you know, they really like makeup and they really like music and that sort of thing. And not that she doesn't, but, you know, she definitely sets herself apart from that. And I wonder how that sort of goes down back home. I'd be interested to see.
To be honest, I don't know the answer to it. I don't know kind of even if it's possible to get your hands on a copy in Iran or mm-hmm. what the reception is. But I guess one thing that that is important to remember when thinking about Iran today is that it's such a young population. Mm-hmm. I think the stat that gets bandied about is something like 70% of people in Iran are under the age of 30.
Well.
And yeah, it's incredible. And, you know, in spite of the restrictions, you know, they are big on social media and mm-hmm. It is possible to kind of access huge amounts of Western culture if you know how to. So I think from that perspective, it's probably moved on quite a bit since she was growing up in Iran. And I think a lot of people in the West would be quite surprised if they visited Tehran and kind of saw, you know, the young mm-hmm. people and the fashions and the kind of popular culture there today.
My experience of Iran, not I've never been, it's the culture that comes out of it as well, because there's the Iranian New Wave mm-hmm. cinema recently. So you've got them, the Makbalhavs and Kiarostami Astami. And that, again, is presenting a very different world of Iran than mm-hmm. is presented in Persepolis.
It's interesting to see how it all balances out, although she does make it clear in the book as well that class is a big factor. Mm-hmm. And I like there are a couple of stories where she covers the sort of intrinsic class distinctions between her and the other people. Like, for example, her maid that poses as her sister to get the attention of her neighbour. She makes it clear that she doesn't agree with it, but she also has acknowledged that that is part of the system that she can't really do anything about.
Yeah, but also I think it's something that she carries with her even when she leaves Iran. Like, I don't know if you guys remember the point at which she goes to stay with her mum's friend, Zozo. Mm. This woman's husband used to be a CEO in Iran, and I think they're arguing over money, the husband yeah. and wife. And she says something like, I felt quite embarrassed to hear them arguing over money. My parents never argued over money.
Yeah.
But then my dad was never a failure, or, you know, yeah. my dad was never incompetent, something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, she says incompetent. I was like,
yes, mm. yeah, it's quite sort of a strong word, and it's obvious that she's sort of carried a lot of those kind of ingrained mm-hmm. prejudices with her into the
yeah.
West.
She doesn't have a problem with showing her privilege, how that affects her life. And I think that's actually quite a brave thing to do, because it can be quite scary putting forward and being like, actually, here are the areas where I still have things to work through. I think that's quite a strong
thing.
Yeah,
I wonder how the family feel about things like that. Hmm. And I think that's a problem across all autobiographical works and yeah. comics mm-hmm. as well. Yeah.
Because it is very much a memoir, isn't it? Because I think the first time I read it, I wasn't necessarily sure how much kind of her personal story would be foregrounded. And it really is, especially obviously when you come to the second volume of it. And I don't know what you guys think, but I thought that once it got to the second volume, I certainly had less interest in it. I think sort of the initial attraction of it waned, and I think there is something sort of quite compelling about the way she interweaves the history and the memoir in the mm-hmm. first volume that sort of drops away. I mean, there's still quite a lot of interesting social commentary when she goes back to Iran mm-hmm. as an older teenager, but I definitely found my interest waning in the second volume.
I think her time in Vienna is a lot more typical.
Yeah, well, it's more of a just typical personal memoir of her mm-hmm. dealing with her own struggles rather than the, you know, external stuff. However, I mean, obviously all of that is a result and of the political impact that that's had on her life so far.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, we decided to do Persepolis this month because it's a classic graphic novel and one that we thought people who might not generally read graphic novels would be interested in reading. If you were a brand new comic book reader and you were like, right, I've read Persepolis, great, I liked it, what would you recommend they read next?
Well, if they've read nothing else, Daughter of a Father's Eyes, it's a very welcoming book for new readers. I mean, I've spoken to Brian Talbot about this, the artist on the book, and his wife Mary wrote it. He is quite deliberately making the book to not using comic book methods that mm-hmm. would exclude people from reading it. And then Mary's most recent book, actually, Sally Heathcote, Suffragette.
Oh, I just got my hands on it.
Oh, it's
yeah,
great.
It's
really
in my
good.
House waiting mm-hmm. for me to read it.
Drawn by Kate Charlesworth, who does a really good, nice
Oh, right,
style
different artist.
Stuff.
I mm-hmm. thought it was Brian.
I think Brian did the layouts and then Kate did the finished artwork. So.
I see. I'm the brand new comic book reader, so I will take those recommendations on board. I have read Daughter of Our Father's Eyes and I absolutely loved it. So I think there is something mm-hmm. for me in this genre for sure.
Yeah. Have you read Mouse?
I haven't read Mouse.
God, it's so good.
No, it's definitely on the list.
It's amazing. It's very full on, but it's really, really brilliant. And it's an amazing piece of storytelling.
It's many similarities as well. It's like the fact that Spiegelman isn't presenting a particularly nice version of himself.
No,
in
not
quite
at
a
all.
Lot of the
He's
book,
brutally
quite
honest about himself
and
his father.
In a way that Marjane Satrapi is in Persepolis as well.
Mm-hmm. Something I really liked about the book was, as you were talking about earlier, Mona, the fact that Marjane's view, you know, she's being presented as, you know, an authority on Iranian culture when she goes to the West and she's an outsider when she's in Iran, but there's still a national pride there, you know, even though the country is overrun by a regime that she does not agree with and that she struggles day to day to fit in with this world or find her place in it, that there's still a strong tie to Iranian cultural history, to the entire past that she definitely feels very passionately about.
I think that's a brilliant point. And I think actually, just picking up on the title of the book, it's called Persepolis, which is sort of a, you know, an ancient Persian historical site. And there's no, I don't know if maybe I've missed something, but there certainly didn't seem to me to be any mention of, or any tie to the title within the book at all. And I remember thinking sort of, there will be some link at some point, but there doesn't ever seem to be one. But I think certainly as kind of a historical site, Persepolis is kind of writ large in the kind of Iranian consciousness as a reminder of the kind of glory days of the Persian Empire and the like. So I think there is a lot of that that people carry through them, that sort of sense of the depth of history to Iran before it was even called Iran back, you know, when it was the Persian Empire. Mm-hmm. So I think that's absolutely true. And that's something that's certainly true more broadly of Iranians today.
One of the things I wondered about it when I first read it was, does it have to be a comic? I didn't understand why it was a comic and why she chose it. And obviously reading more about it, she was influenced by the people that she was friends with and to tell her story in comic form. But I think if it wasn't a comic, it wouldn't have been the success that it was. It wouldn't have been as accessible. I don't think she does anything spectacular. I think Mona alluded to this earlier with the comic book form. But it does give an accessibility to her story.
I actually, funny enough, I can't really envisage it as anything but a comic.
But it is a film as well.
Yes,
I think the film works almost, the images in the film work better for me than the actual book.
I think they actually go hand in hand really well. I think together, like, I don't think that you would watch one and then not want to read the other, or read one and then not want to watch the other. Like, they just work off each other. And in fact, one of the things I thought this weekend was, could I go watch Persepolis again? Because it was a fantastic adaptation. So we're about done with time for today, but the conversation doesn't have to end here if you don't want it to. If you'd like to tell us what you thought of Persepolis, you can let us know on our website at scottishbooktrust.com, on Twitter at scottishbktrust, or on our Facebook page. Book Talk will be back in a fortnight with Ryan Van Winkle, who will be bringing us a whole new host of author interviews. And then in a month's time, we'll be back with a new novel from Andrew O'Hagan, The Illuminations. So if you want to find out a bit more about the Edinburgh Iranian Festival,
we're at www.ediranfest.co.uk. And the festival runs through to the 16th of February. And we've got Iranian film season at the Film House.
Amazing.
And lots of exciting things as well.
Sounds great. And if you'd like to hear a little bit more about what Damon's up to?
You can follow me on Twitter at Ticking Boy. That's named after my own comic, The Adventures of Ticking Boy. And I'm also involved with the Scottish Centre for Comic Studies in Dundee, where I'm studying my PhD.
Brilliant. So thanks so much again to our guests, Damon and Mona. And thanks for listening, and happy reading.